Our guest today is the United States Attorney for the Northern District of Illinois. He has served as U.S. Attorney for nearly 3 years. Our guest today is the top federal law enforcement official for the 18 counties across the top tier of Illinois, with a population of roughly 9 million people. He manages more than 300 employees, including approximately 170 authorized assistant U.S. attorney positions in Chicago and Rockford. Our guest today was born in Kansas City and raised in Knoxville, Tennessee. He graduated from Vanderbilt University in Nashville, where he also earned his law degree. He's married. His wife, Rachel, couldn't be with us today, and is a proud father of three beautiful children, Harriet, Oscar, and Charles. Also, his parents are here today, Dr. David and Judith Farden. Let's give them a round of applause. His brother, Josh, and his wife, Patricia. Let's give them a round of applause. Now, I forgot one person, Zach, before. I forgot one of my favorite people in the administration. She's the building commissioner, Judy Friedland. Let's give her a round of applause. Thank you. And she's a City Club speaker. Ladies and gentlemen, Zach Farden. Zach.
So thank you, Jay. And I want to thank everybody for being here on a Monday afternoon. A lot of interesting things happening in the city and the world right now, so your choice to join me this afternoon means a lot to me. I want to thank my parents for being here, my brother Josh, his wife Patricia. There are a group of friends from Tennessee who are here as well. Wonderful to have you guys here. Thank you for being here. And maybe most significantly, there is a group, a table full of women and men from the United States Attorney's Office here, and the notion that they would pay money to hear me talk it is truly ridiculous. So I'm going to hope that's the best meal you guys ever had. I do, on a very serious note, want to first express my condolences to Jay and the City Club family for the passing of Paul Green. I only knew Mr. Green, Dr. Green, from having stood on this dais with him the last 2 years in a row. But he made an impression. I mean, obviously a great intellect and a keen wit, but also really put me at ease up here, including in my first year as the U.S. attorney. Just an obvious true gentleman, and I just want you to know that I'm truly sorry for that loss. No different than those first two times I was here in 2014 and 2015, and despite the mission-critical work our U.S. Attorney's Office does in areas like public corruption and corporate crime and cyber crime and counterterrorism and major frauds and narcotics trafficking, I am going to focus my comments today on violent crime in Chicago. But I'm going to talk not just about violence and law enforcement. I'm going to talk about trust. I'm going to talk about civil rights. I'm going to talk about the aspiration of bringing together all the good and wonderful people who are fully committed to fixing what pains us in Chicago, about breaking barriers and finding pathways to change. Everyone in this room knows we are in the midst of a brutal year. Homicides are up more than 40%. Shootings are up about 50%. There is civil unrest. Our police are under a constant microscope. Our streets are teeming in protest. There is anger. There is fear. There is distrust. And with the constant drumbeat of bad news, for some, I think there's even a sense of depression, of hopelessness. And yet, for all of that, I want to tell you what breaks my heart, because my heart breaks every single day in this job. But it is not on account of what's happening this year. It is deeper and wider than that. My heart breaks for reasons I talked about in this room in 2014 and then again in 2015, for reasons that were just as real in 1996 and 2006 as they are today in 2016. We have kids babies, toddlers, adolescents, tweens, and teens being shot as a matter of routine in this city. 30 kids under 13 years old hit with bullets so far this year alone. These are just some of those kids. And this is a slide I showed in this room in 2014 showing just some of the kids shot and killed in Chicago that year. And this is a slide I showed in this room in 2015 showing just some of the kids shot and killed in the city of Chicago that year. Since 2010, over 2,800 kids shot in Chicago. Since 2010, over 2,800 children shot in the city of Chicago. 369 of those shot and killed. And that's not happening here in River North. It's happening in a handful of neighborhoods. Otherwise, in so many ways, wonderful neighborhoods on the south and west side, but neighborhoods that are isolated, traumatized, and terrorized by gun violence. This is our reality today, and this was our reality last year, and this was our reality the year before that, and this has been our reality now for decades. In my 3 years now as the U.S. Attorney, I've been asked more than a dozen times what I think of the word Chirac. I usually take a pass at the question. The word itself is not important to me. But in truth, Chirac, whatever else it may represent, it is now a verbal symbol for the hard reality that Chicago is a tale of two cities, one safe and bucolic, the other dangerous and volatile. Our challenge in Chicago is not measuring today's violence statistics against yesterday's. We've been doing that for decades, and fundamentally nothing has changed. The challenge we need to be talking about is the decades-old social concern of these neighborhoods set apart and these children in those neighborhoods put at risk. That is a right versus wrong challenge. That is a who do we want to be as a city, a community, a society challenge. It's a big challenge, but it's ours. We need to be honest about it and own it and start coming up with better ideas for long-term solutions. I'm going to take the next 20 or 25 minutes and talk about two major moving parts, important from my perspective, to those solutions. First, I'm going to talk about civil rights and policing. And second, I'm going to talk about not-for-profit organizations operating in our most violence-afflicted neighborhoods. Starting with civil rights. 2 years ago, in August 2014, 18-year-old Michael Brown was shot and killed by a police officer in Ferguson, Missouri, and that incident ignited a powder keg of pent-up anger. Issues of force and race and racism and policing were thrust onto the national stage in a way that we had not seen since the Rodney King beating in the 1990s. And unlike the era of Rodney King, we now have cameras everywhere. Every one of you has one in your pocket. And so we started seeing viral videos in an almost constant stream. Eric Gardner dying of a chokehold in Staten Island. Tamir Rice, the 12-year-old, shot and killed in Ohio. Freddie Gray being dragged into the back of a police van in Baltimore. Laquan McDonald shot 16 times, mostly on the ground. More recently, Paul O'Neill shot in the back here in Chicago. There are dozens and dozens of other examples over the last 2 years. Couple of stark examples even in the last 2 weeks in Tulsa and in North Carolina. One or more of these incidents a week across the nation, it seems, and because of technology, these incidents are no longer just local concerns. They are national concerns. They belong to us all, which brings me to today. We are in the midst of a national reform movement around policing and trust. And it is a movement with nothing less at stake than public safety and effective self-governance and belief in our systems of justice. And nowhere is that more true with more at stake than right here in Chicago. In December of last year, the United States Attorney General Loretta Lynch announced a pattern and practice investigation of our Chicago Police Department. I was by her side in Washington when that announcement was made. And since that announcement was made, our office here in Chicago has been working hand in hand with the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department to conduct that investigation of CPD. The pattern and practice investigation is not a criminal investigation. I'll say something in a moment about our federal criminal civil rights cases. The pattern and practice investigation is a sweeping civil review to determine if there have been repeated constitutional violations by Chicago police over the years, especially focused on two areas: use of force, including fatal force, and accountability mechanisms, meaning essentially what happens when bad cops do bad things. Over the last 9 months, our DOJ team, my office working with Maine Justice, has done a deep dive in those areas. They have analyzed tons of data, interviewed hundreds of witnesses, held public forums, conducted ride-alongs with patrol officers, reviewed CPD policies and procedures, scrutinized CPD training, conferred with top experts across the country. This is the largest pattern and practice investigation in the history of the Department of Justice. This is the first time in Chicago's history there has been this kind of review of its police department. So, yes, this is hugely important stuff. We're not done yet with this review, but we are, I believe, moving at a record pace. I won't make predictions because I'm not going to create expectations where there is no certainty. But suffice it to say that we are proceeding with a sense of real urgency, and I think we're on an unprecedented pace to get this review done. Of course, that urgency has to be balanced with efficacy. We've got one shot at this thing, and we have to make sure that we get it right. Assuming we find problems, our goal is not quick fixes. It is sustainable, long-term change. That's what we're about. And sustainable change requires time and care and enormous effort. So that is how we're approaching this historic opportunity. That's on the civil side. Let me, as promised, say something about our federal criminal civil rights prosecutions. Where appropriate, our U.S. Attorney's Office here charges police officers criminally. To do that, we have a limited number of options. Federally, there are no general murder, manslaughter, or assault type crimes. Those are state crimes, and only the state can bring those kinds of charges. Our principal tool for federal prosecution is what's known as the deprivation of rights law, which essentially authorizes us to bring federal charges where we can prove that an officer willfully violated someone's civil rights. To be able to prosecute under that law, we have to be able to prove beyond a reasonable doubt both that the use of force was objectively unreasonable and that the officer acted willfully, knowing that the force used was excessive. Proving that willful state of mind, getting inside the officer's head at the moment force was used, and proving willfulness beyond a reasonable doubt is a high bar. Despite those challenges, our office has dedicated resources and has historically brought impactful criminal cases against officers using excessive force in Chicago and across the Northern District of Illinois. In the last 2 weeks, we've charged two excessive use of force cases, one against a Joliet police officer and the other against a Chicago police officer. And beyond excessive force cases, in recent years, our office has held dozens and dozens of police officers accountable for other forms of corruption, things ranging from stealing from drug dealers to selling drugs to selling guns to theft to perjury and other crimes. We also sometimes investigate police officer cases that are charged by the state and not by us. So let me say something about that interplay between state and federal prosecution when it comes to police misconduct cases. In some cases, even where we find sufficient evidence to charge an officer federally, we will defer to the state when the state moves forward with charges. There are two important reasons for that. First, as I already said, the state has the ability to bring certain charges like murder and manslaughter that carry heavier penalties than our federal charge. In other words, excessive use of force is a context in which the state often carries the bigger criminal stick than the feds, whether we like it or not. That is our reality. Second, very specifically in Illinois, there is a state double jeopardy law that can preclude the state from prosecuting if we, the feds, go first. In light of that law, when the state charges, our office will sometimes decide to wait rather than risk jamming up the state's prosecution. When we make that decision to wait, we monitor the state's case, and when the state is done, we make a decision whether or not to charge federally. And the key factor for us in making that decision is whether we think the state result, including any prison term, has rendered justice. So a lot of layers there. Our criminal justice world is sometimes complicated, and that's okay. The most important thing I want you to know is this. Our U.S. Attorney's Office here has and will continue to independently and vigorously pursue civil rights prosecutions of police officers where appropriate. And let me tell you why. When police officers break the law and commit crimes, it hurts us all. It hurts the immediate victims. It hurts the public who lose faith and confidence in law enforcement. And it hurts all of the good officers who suffer from that loss of public faith and confidence. Those good officers can no longer do their jobs effectively without the support and trust of the public they serve. Let me put a finer point on that. I am someone who believes that police officers are by and large the noblest of our public servants. They are the ones, the women and men who've taken jobs at modest pay where every day they wake up not knowing if they may get hurt or even killed. And damn near all of them do that because they're good people. They risk their lives to serve and protect us all. To succeed, those good officers need credibility with the communities they are serving. And when bad cops do bad things, it hurts those good officers. Among other things, in my opinion, that paradigm can create and foster the exact kind of don't snitch culture we have seen now for decades. In those neighborhoods, South and West Side, that most desperately need police to be able to do their jobs, to solve crimes, to catch those murderers. It is time to fix that. It is time to change that paradigm. It is time to win back the respect those officers have earned. By doing that, we help CPD and we help those afflicted neighborhoods. And we make this city safer and stronger. As I said at the outset, for me, this is not about statistics. It is about fairness. Fairness to all of our neighbors across Chicago. For us to have any chance at succeeding in the long-term goal of correcting the injustice of those neighborhoods set apart and these children in those neighborhoods put at risk. I believe what we're going through right now with CPD was inevitable and is essential. At the moment, we're in pain. Sometimes in life, you have to go through pain to get to a better place. Let me speak more directly for a moment about that pain, a 40-plus percent increase in homicides, a 50% increase in shootings. In 2014, 2015, we saw some of our lowest homicide rates in the city of Chicago since the 1960s. Suddenly, in 2016, the pendulum whips away. Why is that? Well, no one knows for sure, but I think it's worth saying that this spike followed four quick successive events at the end of last year. The city released the Laquan McDonald video. DOJ announced its pattern and practice investigation of CPD. CPD's superintendent of 4.5 years was let go. And coincidental to those first three things, on January 1 of this year, a contract went into effect between the city and the ACLU mandating that officers fill out lengthy contact cards for every street encounter. Now, that's a contract that was negotiated between the city, CPD, and the ACLU last year. It just happened to go into effect on January 1 of this year. And following those four events, which occurred within a six-week time frame leading up to January 1 of this year, I believe there was a hit on CPD morale and a drag on officer willingness to conduct stops. There has, in fact, been a major drop this year in the number of street stops officers are conducting. I also think that the fallout in public confidence, the apparent embattlement of police on all fronts, has created a sense of emboldenment among gangs, especially in our most violence-afflicted neighborhoods. Some gang members apparently have felt they could get away with more, and so more bullets started flying. That perception is wrong, and it will change with time and because of the great efforts our Chicago police are making right now to push back against the violence and to ensure change that will restore credibility. Let me say something about what federal law enforcement, including the United States Attorney's Office, is doing to help our local and state partners during that crisis. In addition to the civil rights work I already mentioned, we're busier than ever at 219 South Dearborn prosecuting gangs and violent offenders. In late July, we announced racketeering indictments against 34 ranking leaders of the Latin Kings street gang for on the west and south side for widespread and recurring violence. Separate from that, earlier this month, we started a federal racketeering trial against members of a Gangster Disciples, Black Disciples, street gang faction who are alleged to have committed multiple murders and other brutal acts of violence over years. That federal racketeering trial is taking place down at 219 South Dearborn as I speak. Those two cases are exemplary. We have many, many other federal gang and violent offender cases charged and in the investigative pipeline. We have not and will not take our foot off that criminal enforcement pedal. In addition, this year, our office has increased its intake of gun cases across the board. We continue to work closely with the state's attorney's office, who are a great partner to us, to make decisions about which sovereign is in a better position to charge putative gun defendants. This year, through that cooperative screening process, we have decided to take on more water federally, specifically in reaction to this crisis, and so that we can make sure that during this challenging time, we're doing everything we can to help, to aid our state and local partners. And to be clear, it is not just the U.S. Attorney's Office that is leaning in to this crisis. It is the entire federal law enforcement family, the FBI, DEA, ATF, United States Marshal Service, other agencies have all ramped up resources to tamp down on this spike in violence. There are specific initiatives we have launched this year with CPD and our state partners, and I'm not going to discuss the details because I don't want to compromise those initiatives. But suffice it to say that the oars of those federal agencies, including the FBI, are in the water right now. We are committed, fully committed, along with CPD and our state partners, to doing everything we can to address this increase in gun violence as quickly and effectively as we can. That's on the criminal enforcement side. Complementary to that, we are also working closely and constantly with CPD and others to try to stop crime before it occurs. This year, our office has led or participated in parolee reentry forums, youth outreach forums, violence reduction strategy, gang call-in meetings, and community trust roundtables on a routine basis. We've had dozens such meetings already this year. Last time I was in this room, I mentioned our youth outreach forums where we're working with at-risk kids 13 to 17 years old to try to help them find a pathway other than gangs and violent crime. I will not rehash that now, other than to say that that program continues, and while no one program is a panacea for our gun violence problem, I am proud that the United States Attorney's Office continues to invest resources and lead the way forward on so many of those important initiatives. Crime prevention is a critical part of our long-term success in fighting violent crime. I do not want to prosecute gun criminals if we can stop that crime from happening in the first place. I'm going to pivot for a minute and say a few words about another concern that I think is important to this overall discussion, and specifically some challenges facing not-for-profit organizations operating in these most violence-afflicted neighborhoods. Last time I was here, which was about 1 year ago, I mentioned that our office had launched a series of community trust roundtables focused on violence and policing issues. We have continued to hold those roundtables, which I have hosted roughly quarterly for the past almost 2 years now. After one in Inglewood earlier this year, I spoke with CPD Superintendent Johnson about doing a separate, smaller series of roundtable discussions with a very specific and discrete purpose: to gather leaders from not-for-profits operating in the neighborhoods that are suffering this year's worst gun violence and find out from those not-for-profit leaders their views and concerns about making the neighborhoods safer. In the past 3 months, my office in CPD has hosted four of those not-for-profit roundtable discussions. We had one in Inglewood, we had one in Austin, one in Garfield Park, and one in Back of the Yards. Each of these meetings was attended by 20 to 30 leaders of not-for-profit organizations providing a broad spectrum of services in their respective neighborhoods, things ranging from healthcare to the indigent, housing and food for the homeless, mental health services, substance abuse, aid, domestic violence assistance, workforce development programs, educational programs, tutoring, youth programs. And these not-for-profit roundtable meetings have been non-public so as to foster candor and honesty. This is the first time I've mentioned these meetings publicly. And to be clear, these meetings are not part of the DOJ pattern and practice investigation or any broader DOJ initiative. This is the U.S. Attorney's Office and me as the U.S. Attorney trying to better understand the other pieces of the puzzle beyond law enforcement's role when it comes to combating gun violence so that we can make sure we're doing everything in our power to complement those other critical areas. So, two key takeaways for me from these not-for-profit roundtable discussions. First, there is an amazing number of super smart, passionate, hardworking, committed, altruistic people providing not-for-profit services in these neighborhoods. And I do not say that lightly, and I don't say it to pander, and I don't say it for hyperbole. I say it because it's true, and I didn't really know it until I went and saw it for myself. There is no shortage of good and smart people trying to help in these neighborhoods. So what? Why does it matter that there's this critical mass of good leaders operating in these neighborhoods? Because of my second key takeaway. They don't have what they need to succeed. At each and every one of these meetings, each attended by different participants operating in different neighborhoods, we heard a single resounding common complaint: the absence of a Marshall Plan or unified vision for working together and cooperating to improve the neighborhoods. In fact, repeatedly, we learned how these leaders and organizations are often siloed, often working apart, and often even in competition. Why is that? Well, the number one thing I heard was that the funding mechanisms, whether state, federal, or philanthropic, are annualized, are hyper-competitive, and are data-driven. And so many of these organizations compete all year, every year, to protect their numbers and bring in funding dollars just so they can survive. That paradigm does not leave a lot of room or incentive for them to stop the music, come together, and come around a common comprehensive plan for attacking gun violence. They want to do that. All of them want to do that. Many, probably most, feel they can't. That paradigm has to change as well. We need for these great people in these communities to be able to work together, to collaborate, to share a vision and plan for improving those neighborhoods. And so I ask everybody in this room, whether you're in the business community, government, or part of the great philanthropic community in the city of Chicago, give that issue some thought and let's have a conversation and find a way to change that paradigm so that all these talented people already working full-time in these neighborhoods can have a greater impact. Now, beyond not-for-profits and law enforcement, there are obviously other major moving parts that we're going to have to address to resolve our gun violence dilemma. And like not-for-profits, those other major moving parts are outside of my office's authority. Equal education is one. We need to ensure that schools operating in these neighborhoods are providing the same quality and continuity of services as schools across the city. Jobs is another. We need more businesses to stake ground in these neighborhoods and create work opportunities, especially for young adults, but also for citizens returning from incarceration, a large percentage of whom return to these same neighborhoods. Those are significant challenges, but I'm telling you, there are good people in city government, in state government, and in the private sector working hard and earnestly on those challenges. There are good people working hard and earnestly on those challenges. And there are success stories, discrete but real, where schools have been improved or new businesses have staked grounds in these neighborhoods. We need to study those success stories and build upon them and come up with a template so that each neighborhood can succeed. Chicago's gun violence problem is multifaceted. It is not rooted in any one thing. It has roots in poverty, in joblessness, in educational inequality, which, yes, over decades has fostered cultural issues and parenting problems and fear and cynicism and, worse yet, a tragic strain of complacency, of hopelessness, of low expectations. Our institutions have to do better. Law enforcement has to do better. Government has to do better. Schools, not-for-profits, we all have to do better. In fact, I would suggest to you that across those institutions, we too often are siloed. For all the good work and will of folks in the public, private, and philanthropic sectors, we don't communicate as much or as effectively as we need to. I believe we are each trying hard to do our jobs, to do our parts, but that's not good enough in the face of this particular challenge. We need to be better at knowing each other, at communicating, and at coming around a common plan where we are complementing and coordinating with each other. That is the only way to win this particular fight. In some small measure, through our roundtables and outreach initiatives, my office is trying to chip away at that challenge. And I commit to you, we're not going to stop. The fantastic women and men of this U.S. Attorney's Office are going to keep pushing. We're going to keep prosecuting violent offenders. We're going to keep looking for creative ways to stop crime before it happens. And we're going to keep listening and learning and striving for long-term solutions to this complex problem. We never lose hope. Giving up is not part of our DNA at 219 South Dearborn. Institutions matter, but at the end of the day, to save innocent kids and to restore neglected parts of this city, the answer is not going to lie in institutions. It is going to lie in people. I am from Tennessee. Chicago is my adoptive home. Each and every year I have lived here, I have fallen more in love with this place and its people. Each and every year, including this year, I have lived here, I have fallen more in love with this place and its people. I am in awe of the fundamental goodness I witness each and every single day from people across this city, the profound strength and love that citizens here have for Chicago and for each other. That strength and love is the fuel that will drive our change. The United States Attorney's Office is honored to be a part of it. I commit to you that we're going to keep working hard every single day. I appreciate you being here, and I appreciate your listening. Thanks a lot.
That was tremendous, wasn't it? And if Zachary was a student of mine when I taught at Vanderbilt for a short period of time, he would have gotten an A-plus in my class. Anyhow, we have a series of questions here. The first one is from City Club member Rich Lenkoff. Rich, where are you?
Right here.
Over there. Start with a quick one.
Sure.
How quickly should video evidence be released to the public?
Well, I mean, there's no right answer, and there's no, I think, one size fits all. Obviously, different cities, different communities across the country are taking on that issue right now and striking the balance in different ways, and the city of Chicago has recently changed its policy on that issue. I won't comment on their policy specifically. That's really would be inappropriate for me to do. Having said that, clearly there is a balance between the public's right and interest in knowing and efficacy in the investigative process and the potential impact that releasing video evidence broadly can have on witnesses who haven't been interviewed or evidence that hasn't been collected. So it is a balance, and the issue is at what point, you know, does that balance fall in favor of public dissemination of information? Again, I think it has to be determined on a community-by-community, city-by-city basis, and the city of Chicago has recently revisited that, and we're going to respect their rules as we always have going forward.
Thank you. The next question I have is from James Boratin, City Club member, World on Fire Films. James, where are you? Okay. I'll get over to this side of the room and in the back in a second or two. The Sun-Times had an article on guns being purchased in Indiana because of lax gun laws and being distributed on Chicago's streets. If these guns are crossing state lines, why isn't the U.S. attorney cracking down on this?
Because he's no good at his job. Yes. Next question. Okay. No, I mean, kidding aside, this is an enormous frustration. We have porous borders in Chicago when it comes to, and I don't need to tell this group, and we got a gun an hour, illegal gun an hour, being taken off the streets by the fantastic women and men of the Chicago Police Department. We have way too many illegal guns in this city. Yes, our borders are porous, and while we've got some, you know, gun laws and regulations here, our sister states maybe don't have quite as strict a laws, and it enables people to bring guns into our communities illegally, and it is a huge problem and a huge concern to me. We do investigate and bring those illegal trafficking cases where we can, but when it's as simple as driving across the border in Indiana and going to a gun show and buying a bag of guns and driving back across the border, you know, shy of stopping every single car as it's driving across Indiana, becomes pretty challenging from a federal law enforcement perspective to be able to catch and prosecute every one of those cases, which is not a punt. We are focused on this, and we're going to continue trying to bring as many impactful federal trafficking cases as we can. We had a very significant one earlier this year where a trafficker who was bringing guns in from Indiana, very much apropos of what I just described, received a 16-year federal sentence. But I do think beyond federal criminal cases and law enforcement, we need to think as a society, as a community, about what we can do from a regulatory perspective to tamp down on that, because it's an enormous problem.
Thank you. This person typed this question out, so they must have thought about it for some time. Michael Rizzo, who identifies himself as a private citizen, questions regarding police misconduct. Chicago Police Lieutenant John Burge supervised systematic torture of suspects for many years without any criminal charges being brought against him at the local level. Finally, he was convicted of perjury, not torture, by your office. The Chicago Police Department is currently being investigated by the U.S. AG's office from Washington. What steps is your office taking to identify and prosecute police misconduct in counties outside of Cook within the Northern District of Illinois?
So thank you. I just talked, you know, at length, obviously, about both civil and criminal efforts vis-a-vis police officer accountability when they break the law. It is worth reiterating, and I mentioned this briefly in my comments, that we have responsibility for the entire Northern District of Illinois, which is all the way, you know, west to the Iowa border and north to the Wisconsin border, and over 9 million people. We are one of the largest districts in the country, and we do have responsibility for officer misconduct cases across that entire geographic territory. We work with local law enforcement in all of those areas. And when I say we, I don't just mean the U.S. Attorney's Office. I mean the FBI and other federal agencies. We have relationships and lines of communication with all those districts. I mentioned that we had charged a Joliet police officer just recently. Joliet is not so far away, but all the way to Rockford and other smaller towns across northern Illinois. We do bring these charges where we learn about them through our local law enforcement and local connections, and we're going to continue doing that. I will say, I don't know that I've ever been here without saying something about resources. We have, Jay mentioned, 170 authorized assistant U.S. attorneys. We're close to 160 now, which was better than last time I was here, but we're still underfunded and understaffed at this U.S. attorney's office. Life is better post-sequestration, but it's still, we were at 172 AUSAs in 2011, and now we're, you know, barely back at 160. And so while I am proud of our office, and I am as confident in our ability to carry this water as any office in the United States of America, I do continue to wish and ask for, you know, Congress to allocate us the funds necessary to fill all those slots.
Okay, thank you. This one is not exactly the type of question we've been responding to, but it's very interesting. Nick Weir, where are you, Nick? Way in the back, okay, in the bleacher seats. The government has been prosecuting criminally commodity traders for spoofing, which seems very ill-defined and is unknown and not understood. What's the plan for further definition?
Well, I am not in the legislature. You know, I'm part of the executive branch, and the spoofing law was part of Dodd-Frank and relates to commodities trading, and it essentially has to do with defrauding the market by submitting buy or sell executions or orders, knowing that you're not actually intending to fill those. So I actually, from our perspective, do not believe that there's a whole lot of ambiguity there. It depends on the particular facts and circumstances of the particular case. But at the end of the day, spoofing is just a vehicle for committing fraud on the market. There are lots of different frauds, ways to commit fraud on the market. Our office is fully committed. We have a securities and commodities fraud team that we put in place in the last few years, and they're doing great work. And I do think it's very important. Look, the economy is one of the pillars that make this nation great and that we all rely upon. And the markets is a pillar of that economy. And if we don't have fair playing fields in our markets, then you also suffer a lack of public trust and confidence that can implode those markets. So it is important that we have market accountability, and there is a role. We're not the only ones, but there is a role for criminal enforcement to manifest that accountability. So while I don't make the laws, nor do I make apologies for the laws and for those tools that we have to make sure that our markets are fair and that when people knowingly, willfully defraud others through the marketplace, we're going to step up and we're going to bring those cases.
Thank you. And if you're not familiar with spoofing, just ask Siri. She'll go into a longer explanation. This is from a gentleman who's a Loyola Law University student. I think it means third year. But he's a current intern in your office for the Northern District of Illinois.
At least for now.
At least for, right. Make sure you get paid through November. Okay. Xavier Vergara. Where are you, Xavier? Ah, I knew he'd come over to this side of the room. Good. It's a very simple question, particularly this year. If you had to choose between the Sox and the Cubs, who would it be?
Xavier, you're safe. Thank you for volunteering in our office. We have a lot of great people who come through our office, and it really is important. I mean, among other things, frankly, many, many of our assistant U.S. attorneys in the office interned at the office at some point in time. So it is good to have you. Blackhawks is my answer. I will say we got a lot of tough things happening in the city of Chicago right now. And for those of you who are enjoying watching the Cubs, both what they're doing and the mojo with which they're doing it, I am right there with you.
Great, great. We have a couple more questions, ladies and gentlemen. And Xavier had a more serious question, but we'll hold it to get the other questions in. This is from Pat Giordano, Giordano & Associates, right over there. In your opinion, why is the violence problem much greater in Chicago than New York when it used to be the opposite?
Well, you know, here's what I would say. We are much different as a city than New York or Los Angeles, for that matter. And we could have a very extended conversation about the different things that New York has done over the years to bring down their violence problem, and we have studied that, and we talk about it, and we've adopted a number of those things. But the reality is that what I just showed you and what I just talked about, that frankly is what I talked about in this room in 2014 and 2015, that's Chicago. That's not New York. We have a decades-old entrenched gang and youth violence problem and culture in this city that New York simply does not suffer. And I don't think that makes us worse than New York. I'll take Chicago over New York 10 times out of 10. The reality is that this is part and parcel of who we are, and we as a city, as a community, have to step up and do better and address it. I think we're in the midst of doing that. I think that for all the pain and consternation, there is a positive in that we're coming together and we're talking and we're focusing and change is afoot. And I am and remain hopeful that over time we're going to address this issue and problem. And in the meantime, I couldn't be more proud to call Chicago home.
Okay, thank you. This is from a former student of mine, Chester Kropodlowski, who, among other things, would direct all the barriers for the Chicago Marathon until he was hit one year by an errant driver. But he came back very quickly. Chester, glad to have you here. The question is, the John Bills case, big money paid out. Were you able to find where the money ended up?
So, I mean, we tried that case earlier this year, and it was an over 2-week trial, and obviously a lot of evidence, and I'm not necessarily comfortable, nor do I think it would be appropriate for me to sit up here and brusquely in broad strokes characterize that evidence. But what I will say is this, that this is the red light cameras case, the John Bills case, and yes, this was a corrupted contract, and a contract the corruption of which came at great cost to the city and the taxpayers. I believe that federal law enforcement, our office included, but the FBI, IRS, working with the Inspector General's office of the city of Chicago, did what we needed to do from an investigative perspective to turn every stone we could turn and find everything that we could find. I'm not going to say whether or not we're done yet, but I will say that we have been unrelenting. I grew up as a public corruption prosecutor in this office, and I talked already about fraud on the markets. Public corruption is unacceptable to me at a personal level, and certainly I know to us as a society. We have to pursue and ferret out corruption where we find it in the public ranks, and we have done everything we can do, and we'll continue doing that, including in connection with the red light cameras case.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. And the final question. Xavier, you're a very lucky young man. Remember this. When you get a paying job, we expect you to spend $50 and join the city club. Mr. Farden, could you comment on the link between the inequality in housing and violence in Chicago?
Well, you know, I do think housing is obviously a specific manifestation of poverty. But, you know, I mentioned that we had done these community roundtables in Inglewood and Austin and Garfield Park and Back of the Yards. If you actually pull up, it's easy to do, pull up the poverty rates in those neighborhoods and compare them to the poverty rates in other neighborhoods across Chicago. It is astounding. It is astounding. And yes, if people don't have money, they're not going to have quality housing. And if there isn't money in these communities, then quality housing won't be built, won't be available, won't be accessible. And so, yeah, that is a manifestation of a broader problem, which is that these communities are too long neglected and underserved. And look, I say that brusquely and swiftly. The reality is that that's a decades-old problem in the making, and we're not going to flip a switch and fix it today or tomorrow or overnight or this year. I won't be the U.S. Attorney's office. I won't be the U.S. Attorney when these issues are resolved and we can all feel better about it, which really gets to my overarching point. And it's true, you know, in terms of poverty and all of these other interconnected issues, we have to keep a long view. We're in pain right now. This is a bad year. This spike is a bad thing. We have to keep a long view. We can't take our eye off the ball. We have to take a holistic approach and address the root of these problems. And we have to each own our own responsibility in addressing that. But we also have to get better at talking to each other and figuring out how we as pieces of the puzzle connect. Because it's going to take all of that, and it's going to take it over years to address the housing concerns, to address the poverty concerns, to address the educational concerns, and the cultural issues, parenting and low expectations that I've already talked about along with those. These are generational issues, and this is a generational vision that we have to correct this problem. Having said that, very long answer to a very straightforward question, it is accomplishable. And as I stand here now, I absolutely believe we will get there, but we got to keep our heads down, we got to be honest, and we got to keep pushing.
Thank you.